The Record Podcast is supported by Sound Solutions, providing counseling and therapeutic services to help with life's challenges such as depression, anxiety, addiction, and more, with personalized care that helps patients restore balance to their lives. With 7 locations serving King County, more at soundsolutions.health. Sound Solutions. Care today.
Welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Paul Allen died this week of complications from non-Hodgkin lymphoma. You're going to learn from a University of Washington oncologist what we still don't understand, what we can't get at about this disease. So that's coming up. I hope you can stay tuned. First of all, over the next few days, we are talking about 4 state ballot measures that you get a chance to vote on this November. We have been debating these 4 initiatives, and our second debate today asks, should Washington put more limits on the buying and storing of some guns? And we'll get into the specifics there. The measure includes increased background checks, training requirements, age restrictions, wait periods, criminalizing some improper storages of firearms, so-called. And we have a couple of guests here, a guest from the Yes campaign and the No campaign, and we're going to meet them in just a moment. First, KUOW's Olympia correspondent, Austin Jenkins, is, of course, covering this statewide issue. Welcome, Austin.
Thanks for having me.
Would you give us your point of view on how these gun regulations would work if passed?
Well, I think what they aim to do and how they would work is definitely a matter of debate, but here's what the initiative would require if it passes, and you've alluded to some of this. We'll get a little more specific here. First off, it would raise the age to purchase a semi-automatic rifle to 21. Currently, you can purchase at 18. It would impose a 10-day waiting period on the purchase of such rifles, and it would require a local in addition to federal background check similar to what's currently required for pistol purchases. Prior to purchasing a semi-automatic rifle, a person would also have to have taken a firearm safety class within the last 5 years. As you noted, there's also a safe storage component to this initiative. The measure would allow prosecutors to charge gun owners with felony community endangerment in cases where a gun owner fails to secure their gun and a prohibited person, like a child or a convicted felon, gets their hands on the gun and someone is injured or killed. So we're talking about an accidental shooting or perhaps a fatal shooting with criminal intent. It would be a gross misdemeanor if a prohibited person obtained the gun and used it to threaten someone or in the commission of a crime or if the gun was discharged but no one was hurt or killed. Now, the initiative says if your gun is stolen from you and you report it within 5 days of discovering the theft, then those community endangerment provisions don't apply. The initiative also says that prosecutors can decline to prosecute in situations where it would serve no public purpose. I want to mention this would also require gun dealers at the time of purchase to offer to sell or give the buyer a secure storage device. Dealers would also have to prominently post a warning about the potential for criminal prosecution, and dealers would be able to charge customers up to $25 per purchase to defray the costs of implementing these new rules.
That's a lot, Austin.
Well, it's a 30-page initiative.
Yes, indeed. And I've heard it called the most restrictive gun laws in the country if this were to pass.
Well, that's something for your guests to debate, mm-hmm. I think. But I one of the things that gets talked a lot about is what about these rifles? And, this initiative contemplates the term, it repeatedly uses the term semi-automatic assault rifle.
Right.
That's used repeatedly. And that conjures an image of a rifle that has a military or a tactical look to it, like the popular AR-15. If you read the definition of a semi-automatic assault rifle in this initiative, it's clear that this applies to any semi-automatic rifle, regardless of its appearance or style. So I think that that's an important point to make. Also, just in terms of where these provisions apply and to whom, there's the specifics around these semi-automatic rifles, but regarding the safe storage provisions, that would apply to all firearms. So whether you're talking about pistols, rifles, shotguns, whatever you have in the house or that you carry with you, you would be responsible for safely storing.
And why is this on the ballot now, Austin?
Well, the short answer is because the legislature didn't take action on this topic. And so the Washington Alliance for Gun Responsibility, as it's done twice before since 2014, is taking this issue directly to voters. Remember, 2014, it was universal background checks. In 2016, it was extreme risk protection orders. This year, it's this initiative. And I think it's worth noting what this initiative does not do. It doesn't ban so-called assault rifles. It doesn't limit magazine capacity, as Attorney General Bob Ferguson and others have previously proposed and supported.
And which groups make up the yes and no campaigns for Initiative 1639?
Well, as we've seen in past years, it's a group of mostly wealthy individuals who are bankrolling the pro or yes campaign, including the late Paul Allen, as well as Nick and Leslie Hanauer, Steve and Connie Baumer, also former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg's group, Every Town for Gun Safety. So far, the campaign has raised about $4.6 million. There are several no campaigns registered. The group that's raised the most, although it pales in comparison, is the Washingtonians and the National Rifle Association for Freedom. It's raised about $456,000. The top donors are the National Rifle Association and the Bellevue-based Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms.
Thank you to our correspondent in Olympia, Austin Jenkins. Austin, thanks for setting this up for us as we decide how to vote. We appreciate it.
Sure thing.
So that is a sketch of Initiative 1639 on your November ballot, putting new restrictions on state gun owners and people who want to buy a gun. And we want to debate the pros and cons of this now. We have with us from the Yes on 1639 campaign, a citizen sponsor and a campaign spokesperson, Paul Kramer. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Bill. Glad to be here.
Let's get Paul's microphone on. Thank you, yep. Paul. And also from the No on 1639 campaign, a volunteer with the campaign and a personal firearm instructor, Jane Milhans. Welcome, Jane.
Thank you for having me here.
I was telling the both of you earlier as we sat down, because we're about to disagree in some ways on what's good policy or not, but we agree on a lot. So I thought I would begin by asking the two of you, what do you think that the two of you agree on here? Paul, I'll start with you.
Well, I would hope that there's a number of things that we could agree on, starting with the importance of safety training in advance of purchase. Also, the importance of background checks, and the importance of safe storage. We may disagree on how to implement those or how those should be conducted, but I would hope that we could agree on the importance of all three of those. There may be other areas of common ground as well.
Jane, what do you think about common ground? Where do you agree with Paul, do you figure?
Well, I do agree that people should have safety training, because that's what I do.
Mm-hmm.
However, the training in this initiative I don't agree with, and I do agree that people see firearm ownership is a right and a privilege that other countries don't get to enjoy, and firearms by themselves are neither safe nor unsafe by themselves, but when a person is trained and trained to take safety training, then firearms are safe. And all of the issues like storage and so forth are part of training courses already.
Well, let's start with the storage, since we were just talking about that. Paul, what kind of storage is required by Initiative 1639 of guns?
The initiative doesn't actually require safe storage. An individual gun owner still has freedom to store their gun or not as they wish. What it does do is hold gun owners responsible if an unsecured firearm were taken by a person who was not legally allowed to have that weapon, and then it was used to hurt themselves or someone else, then that gun owner would be held responsible. The intention of this safe storage measure is to reduce accidental shootings, to reduce suicides, to reduce gun thefts, and to reduce homicides with stolen guns. There's a number of ways in which the guns could be stored safely in a safe or a trigger lock. Let me make clear right from the get-go that it in no way criminalizes safe storage, because when a gun owner is at home, they can have the firearm out and with them readily available to have instant access to their firearm.
Jane, what issues do you take with that, as Paul says, holding people responsible for the safe storage of their guns?
Okay, the initiative is very poorly written and vague. I survived a home invasion. So firearm ownership and the teaching of women how to protect themselves is really important to me. And in this initiative, it clearly states you have to store your firearm. So when you're in, and it talks about safe storage or trigger locks in here. And so my oldest student this year was 85 years old. She walks with a cane. She's a widow. There is in no way that woman would be able to quickly get to a gun safe, unlock it if somebody was barging in her door. And so it's right here in the initiative that the guns have to be locked up or have a trigger lock. So
even when home, I heard Paul saying that you can have your gun any way you want when you're at home.
It just says it has to be. It doesn't say in the initiative when you're at home. So another thing that a lot of women are concerned about is all gun owners, is the felony convictions of a firearm owner. Your locked door is not considered safe storage under this initiative. So it either has to be in some kind of safe storage or a trigger lock. And so if an unauthorized person gets in your house and you don't report it in 5 days, you know, you're ending up another felony charge here. And so it's very much criminalizing personal protection.
Paul?
Well, it's very simple. The phrase that Jane just spoke, if it's not reported within 5 days, then the gun owner could be held responsible and could receive a felony charge if that gun was stolen and used in a crime. All they have to do is report it, and then they're not going to be charged with a crime.
Paul, if you heard the idea that if someone's breaking into your home, you might just have seconds to react. Do you think that a locked gun, a quote-unquote safely stored gun, means that a victim could be less able to defend themselves?
I've heard from some firearm owners, and they've said that they've been able to retrieve their firearm from a locked safe in like 4 seconds. That's fast. But again, I would emphasize that if the gun is in the person's possession in their home, it doesn't have to be locked up if it's in their possession and under their control.
Is there any disagreement about that language in the ballot, Jane, that if it's in your possession and under your control, it doesn't have to be locked up?
It does not say in this initiative. It says it has to be locked. I don't see that anywhere in this initiative. I've read it through many times.
Paul, is that spelled out? I just want to make sure we can get clear as we can on that for the listener.
The intention is that the gun be safely stored when it's not in the owner's possession.
Yeah, and it does not say, though, when the person's in their home. The other concern I have is the average person, yes, can get to a gun safe in 4 seconds. But talk about the elderly, the people that are disabled in wheelchairs or things like that. I timed a 70-year-old student a few months ago. Go to your safe, get your gun out. It took her 15 minutes. A lot could happen in 15 minutes.
Let's talk about the issue. Again, this is Initiative 1639 on your November ballot, and we're talking with the Yes and the No campaign. Let's talk about the issue of the age restrictions. Jane, what is wrong with limiting 18 to 20-year-olds to using handguns and non-semi-automatic long guns as they can? This restriction would be on semi-automatic rifles.
Okay. Couple of things. The youngest students I teach are 9-year-old Girl Scouts. Many of the Girl Scouts go on to be competition shooters. One thing about shooting athletics is the athletic ability is leveled between boys and girls often excel. So many students go on to try to compete for college scholarships for that athletic sport. When they turn 18 and are heading back east to college, they would like to take their competition rifle with them back to college. However, if the age limit goes up to 21, we are telling these students, you don't get that college scholarship because you're 18. Mom and dad can't hand the rifle to someone else because that was a former initiative a few years back. So that's number one.
If there was some carve-out for competitive team shooters or something, would that satisfy your
Well, I still don't like restricting adults, and I'll tell you a second reason why. You have a lot of single mothers. You have a lot of single women. You have a lot of, wives whose husbands are deployed that want to be able to protect themselves. Now, women are the fastest growing group of gun owners in America. The most popular rifle amongst women is the modern sporting rifle. The modern sporting rifle is sometimes referred to as an Armalite rifle. Armalite designed the stock. Sometimes it's referred to as an AR. This initiative insultingly calls it an assault weapon. And the reason why women choose this rifle is they can be adjusted to our smaller sizes. And the other thing is there's very little to no recoil. And for home defense, there's home defense ammunition, which is much safer. This initiative would force these women into high recoil, bolt action, pump action, shotgun, 30-06, you name it, that are really unsafe for women to use because of that high recoil. So it is restricting these women for the firearm that works best for their age, because that's all they can get at that age. And it's telling these women, you can't protect yourself in your home.
Okay. Paul, what do you say? You're talking about age restrictions on semi-automatic rifles.
Right now in Washington State, you need to be 21 years old to buy a handgun.
Yeah, I misspoke about that. It's the hunting. It's the non-semi-automatic rifles that are legal for 18 to 20-year-olds, right? Yeah. What
this initiative seeks to do is match the requirements for the purchase of semi-automatic rifles with the requirements in place for handguns. It would leave available other rifles and shotguns for 18 to 20-year-olds. I'd like to say a little bit more about why I think that makes sense. I'm sponsoring and supporting this initiative because my then 18-year-old son, Will, was shot in the back with a semi-automatic assault rifle at a gathering of friends in a private loving home in Mukilteo in 2016. He was nearly killed. Will was lucky enough to survive, but three of his friends were not. I've witnessed and shared their parents' extreme grief over the loss of their children. No family should lose a child to a senseless act of gun violence. No kid should have to worry about getting shot when they get together with their friends or when they go to school.
And are you saying the age restriction is related to that because of the maturing teenage brain?
Yes. And just to cut to the chase, if Initiative 1639 had been in place in 2016, the 19-year-old gunman would not have been able to purchase the Ruger AR-556 that he used to seriously injure my son and kill three of his friends. That shooting would not have happened like it did. There's lots of research that shows that the human brain is developing and isn't really fully mature until the age of 25. Rental car companies know this. There's a disproportionate number of homicides conducted by the 18 to 20-year-old group. And to ask that age group to wait a few more years for them to mature until they're 21 to purchase these highly lethal semi-automatic weapons, like is required, currently required for handguns, it only makes sense.
Jane, we do restrict things by age in some cases, buying alcohol or pot, adopting a child, getting a pilot's license, getting into nightclubs and casinos. What is wrong with the age limits given the developing teenage brain?
Okay, as I mentioned to you, a lot of young women are going to have to give up a college scholarship. Also, it denies young women, 18 to 20-year-olds, with the right to buy a firearm that works the safest for them. If you look at ballistics tests of ammunition between a .223 caliber, which is your AR-15, and a 30-06 pump bolt-action rifle. The 30-06 makes a bigger hole in something than does your standard modern sporting rifle. And the other thing, too, is the modern sporting rifle that has home defense or critical defense ammunition, so it's safer than like a 30-06. So, for example, critical defense ammunition, when it hits a wall, it'll stop. Versus a 30-06 or those pump action, bolt action, high caliber rifles, the bullet that's on the top of the casing could go through a wall into the neighbor's yard or house or something.
We're discussing Initiative 1639, which would impose restrictions, new restrictions on state gun owners and people who want to buy a gun. That was Jane Milhans, a personal firearm instructor with the No on 1639 campaign. Paul Kramer is the spokesperson for the Yes on 1639 campaign. Let's talk about campaign money. Paul, most of your campaign's money comes from wealthy people, the late Paul Allen, Steve Ballmer, venture capitalist Nick Hanauer, former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Why should people who could afford to live in secure places restrict the gun storage of people who can't afford that?
First, I'd like to express my gratitude to those large donors, Paul Allen in particular. We also have a broad range of support from thousands of volunteers all across the state that have worked hard to gather signatures and that are out knocking on doors in support of this initiative. So the support for it is widespread. And we'll see on Election Day what the will of the people of Washington State is.
Jane, shootings involving semi-automatic weapons cause 80% more injuries and 60% more deaths. How could we curb deaths through attacks, not to mention suicides, without limiting access to those type of firearms?
Well, first of all, we have to look at punishing the criminal. This initiative is so poorly written, and I will say that I find it appalling that three billionaire men out of King County want to restrict the rights of women firearm owners in the state. I find that very insulting when they have armed protection. In fact, if you look on Google Maps outside of the late Paul Allen's house, you will see a person standing outside his property on Mercer Island with a semi-automatic and a holster. So this initiative, again, it's so vague. It's a wolf in sheep's clothing, actually. So although it looks good on the outside, on the inside, all it's doing is attacking law-abiding firearm owners. And that's why four law enforcement groups have come out against this. The Washington State Patrol Troopers Association, the Washington State Sheriffs Association, Washington State Council of Police and Sheriffs, and the Washington State Law Enforcement Firearm Instructors Association all say that this initiative does nothing to stop crime. It just is attacking on people's civil liberties, and that what needs to happen is punishing the criminal who is committing the acts. And if you look at the FBI report that just came out from last year, rifle homicides are one of the lowest. More people are killed from stabbings, blunt objects, and also hands and fists.
But we do punish shooters, right?
If somebody commits a crime, they are punished. But some of the crimes, let me talk about safe schools, if I can, for a second. Safe schools is a part of this is, like I say, it's a wolf in sheep's clothing. Nothing in this initiative is for school safety. For example, the largest cause of death in schools is suicides. And kids are committing suicide by hanging, strangulation, and asphyxiation because of being bullied. Nothing in this initiative addresses bullies. Secondly, it's relationships. And so when people see on social media somebody that's been ticked off from bullying, I mean, nothing happens to that person for not reporting it. And the second thing about safe schools is historically, more kids have died in schools from fires than anything else. Yet in the 60s, They installed safety equipment throughout the whole school system, and not one child has lost their life. So in the schools, in this initiative, there's nothing done to protect the facility. There is nothing for security doors. It is easier to walk into a school than it is to many banks or businesses. There's no armed security. There's no personal protection training. Nothing to protect the facility. So this initiative will do nothing to stop deaths in schools.
Paul, any reaction and any final pitch you want to make to voters ahead of this November ballot initiative 1639?
Well, I appreciate that Jane mentions bullying and relationships and the importance of reporting alarming messages on social media. That's all important, and that all needs to be addressed. For the purpose of reducing gun violence and saving lives, I invite our listeners to vote yes on Initiative 1639, Safe Schools, Safe Communities. Too many of our young people today are forced to live with the fear of being shot because gun violence has become a routine part of American life in our schools and in our communities. The status quo needs to change, because right now our laws are not doing enough to prevent Washington families from experiencing the same pain and tragedy from mass shootings that my family did. It's not right, and it doesn't have to be this way. Initiative 1639 is the most comprehensive gun violence prevention measure ever put forward in the state of Washington. It addresses many of the root causes of gun violence by ensuring that every step of the way there are safeguards in place to make sure people use their firearms safely and to keep guns from falling into dangerous hands.
Paul Kramer, a citizen sponsor, campaign spokesperson, yes on 1639. We're just about out of time. Jane, what point do you want to make? You haven't made yet on the no side on 1639.
Yes. Well, as a survivor of a home invasion and somebody who's heard millions or hundreds of stories, I'll say, of women who are survivors of abuse or something, this initiative does nothing for safety. It's just, and the other thing we didn't get into is it waives your HIPAA medical rights of privacy, which is very invasive of as well. The safety training they talk about in here will probably be expensive because it requires teaching how not to commit suicide. And so the two full-day classes, because I volunteer my time, I charge $45. And so this will go up, and it'll restrict lower-income people from getting the training. I also would have to go through the training. But I encourage everyone to vote no. This is nothing more than a wolf in sheep's clothing. There is nothing in it that's going to make schools safer. And that's why those four law enforcement organizations came out opposed to it. No one consulted with law enforcement to draft this initiative, and that's why the law enforcement said it's just poorly written.
Okay.
Now, we both agree schools need to be safer, but there's a better way to do it.
Jane Milhans with the No on 1639 campaign and arguing for and against this measure, giving Washington some of the toughest gun laws in the nation, and you'll get a chance to decide this November. I want to thank both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
We're going to continue our series of ballot debates next week, too. KUOW reporter Austin Jenkins is with us for another final moment from Olympia. He's been looking into this proposed ballot initiative. Austin, would you just briefly, we've heard arguments pro and con, but someone who's just tuning in might want to hear from you or a reporter's reminder of what this ballot initiative would do.
Sure. And, you know, one of the debates that you heard play out there is, does this or does this not require secure gun storage? And what's interesting is that the intent language clearly speaks to secure gun storage requirements and the fact that the sponsors believe that will increase public safety. If you read the actual language, it doesn't say you have to securely store your gun, but if you don't, it also clearly says you can be held criminally liable, and we talked about under what circumstances. So the intent language versus the new section in the proposed initiative are where I think you're hearing those two sides and that debate emerge. More broadly, Bill, I think what you're really hearing is just fundamental philosophical differences between gun owners and people who don't believe there needs to be more government regulation of firearms and those who believe that current regulations fall short or inadequate. You can debate the details of this, but on issues, especially around guns, I think you're really getting into deeper philosophical differences.
And finally, Austin, what are the polls telling us on this?
Well, the recent Crosscut Elway poll shows that this initiative is polling very well at 59%, has a 25% point advantage right now. And, you know, what's interesting about that is that generally the rule of thumb is that when you propose an initiative, you need to be at 60% support because you're going to lose support over time. Right now, it's looking like this initiative has not lost much support since day one. It's polling very well, and it looks like it's likely to pass as the other two in recent years have.
We'll see. KUOW Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins talking about ballot initiative 1639, the gun law initiative that you'll be deciding on. Austin, thanks for this.
You're welcome.
We'll be right back with more of The Record in just a moment. It's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen's death has put a spotlight on one of the most common cancers in the United States, non-Hodgkin lymphoma. 75,000 people will be diagnosed with it this year, and almost 20,000 are expected to die from it. What treatments are available and how successful are they? My guest is Dr. Ajay Gopal, oncologist at the University of Washington School of Medicine. Doctor, thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Bill.
Briefly, what is non-Hodgkin lymphoma?
Non-Hodgkin lymphoma is a cancer of lymphocytes. It's a cancer of white blood cells and really a cancer of the immune system. It usually presents itself with enlarged lymph nodes or low blood counts, sometimes with frequent infections. As we're going to talk about, we've made some tremendous advances but still have lots of work to do in this area.
What do we know about what causes it?
We really don't know. There is some association with exposure. There are some familial predispositions to non-Hodgkin lymphoma. And there are some lymphomas that are associated with certain virus exposures. But in terms of a clear-cut association like with other cancers, we really don't know.
Why is it so hard to treat?
Actually, it is quite treatable. As compared to other cancers, even when non-Hodgkin lymphoma is very advanced, we have many very effective therapies. But as you stated, still we lose about 20,000 people each year in the U.S. to this diagnosis, to this disease. And we still have some work to do in terms of developing better therapies.
What is the most common therapy now?
Well, I think the point to make really with non-Hodgkin lymphoma is that we understand the biology so much more about this disease, and we realize that it's a complicated set of diseases, at least 40 different diagnoses within non-Hodgkin lymphoma. And our therapies are getting tailored to the individual subtype. So there isn't probably a single therapy that I can say is the appropriate approach for the majority. It really depends on the subtype of non-Hodgkin lymphoma.
Paul Allen's family said he died of complications from the disease, and I know you're not involved in his course of treatment. What could it mean to die of complications from non-Hodgkin lymphoma rather than from the disease itself? Or are we talking about essentially the same thing?
Yeah, it's very hard to know without knowing the details, as you state, but sometimes very aggressive approaches that we use when people have relapsed disease result in a decreased immune system, and infections can be common. So that could be one explanation as to what happened. Sometimes the medicines we use themselves can have side effects, which sometimes rarely, thankfully, can only be fatal. So it could be related to the side effects of the therapy.
I'd like to talk about money, Doctor, because I know there are advanced oncoming drug therapies and immunotherapies that I assume are expensive. And I guess I thought that of all people, maybe Paul Allen could afford a cure. His death made me feel like maybe hope is even farther than I thought. Does any of that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's sometimes the incorrect impression that money can buy everything. And you know, there are some very expensive therapies. This is a challenge regarding our healthcare system, but without knowing the details, it's hard to know if these expensive immunotherapies that have been recently made available would even have been appropriate for him. But, you know, I think the take-home point, as you're making, is that we have improved survival significantly over the last decade or two in non-Hodgkin lymphoma. We have many options, but we still have work to do, and we need funding for the research side of things as well.
Do you have any sense of how hopeful we can be in the near term?
I'm very hopeful. I mean, I come to work every day hopeful and with the intention to have good things turn out for my patients. I think we have to have that attitude, but we also have to face the reality that we still have a lot of work to do. And I think when speaking to patients, it's important to make sure, because it's a rare and very biologically complex disease, that they see someone who has experience in treating non-Hodgkin lymphomas because of the biological complexity and the multiple choices that we have now.
And finally, doctor, can you give us non-scientists a sense of what the biggest hope is when it comes to non-Hodgkin lymphoma?
Well, you know, I think the biggest hope gets back to the fundamental science and understanding the biology. What we're understanding now is that much of the reason we get cancers, including non-Hodgkin lymphoma, is the evasion of the immune system. And we are now we have multiple strategies to harness the immune system to fight the cancer, whether it's taking out immune cells and re-engineering them and reinfusing them, or simply really stimulating our own immune system to go back and attack the malignancy. So I think in the future we're really going to see more immunotherapeutic strategies, and we'll look back on what we do now and sort of wonder how we actually could do that.
That's Dr. Ajay Gopal, oncologist at University of Washington School of Medicine, telling you about current treatments and hope for non-Hodgkin lymphoma. Doctor, thanks a lot for this.
My pleasure, Bill. Thank you.
Again this week, Paul Allen died of complications from that disease. You're listening to The Record on KUOW, and in just a moment, KUOW's Jeannie Yandel and Sydney Brownstone are going to come talk to you about politics and sexual harassment. I hope you can stay tuned to The Record.
This is The Record. I'm Jeannie Yandel. When a male political figure is accused of sexual harassment or assaults, we often hear a familiar narrative.
Right now, any woman can say anything and a man's career is ruined.
That idea that allegations primarily affect the alleged perpetrator's career leaves out a piece of the story. And here with me to discuss that is KUOW reporter Sydney Brownstone, who's reported on allegations against State Representative Matt Manweller, State Senator Joe Fain, and Seattle restaurant owner and liberal activist Dave Meinert. Hi, Sydney.
Hey, Jeannie.
So how do you think the work culture in politics is different from other workplaces?
I think there's a narrative that's really convenient in politics where it's really easy to blame the victim by saying that their motivation is political. I think that also because of the public nature of politics, the reputational consequences are higher for both the accused and the accuser. And also politics is an industry that's based on this constant exchange of power. So I think that power dynamics between men and women are subject to the same abuses that we see anywhere else, maybe in an even more heightened sense.
Hmm. Well, so far you've reported on two Washington politicians that were accused of sexual assault. You also reported allegations against a prominent local political activist. What happened with each of those men?
So Representative Matt Manweller was accused of having an underage relationship with one of his former students, and his colleagues in the Washington State Legislature called on him to resign. He was also fired from his post at Washington State University, Central Washington University, my bad. But he has decided to stay in his reelection campaign but resign upon winning. And this way, it's guaranteed that his seat will go to a Republican. Senator Joe Fain, 2 weeks ago, a former Seattle official and Seattle woman, Candace Faber, tweeted that he had raped her in 2007. And she tweeted this 15 minutes after the Kavanaugh hearings concluded. She said that she was inspired by the testimony of Dr. Christine Blasey Ford. And he's still running. He has yet to face any sort of investigation or consequences, even though he has called for an investigation. He has denied those allegations. And Dave Meinert, very well-known business owner in the political scene, in the restaurant scene, in the bar scene, he has pretty much disappeared from the public sphere recently. He was widely criticized, though he still remains owner of the Five Point Cafe.
Hmm. Well, how do those situations compare with what we see happening on the national level? You just brought up the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, for example.
I think it's similar because in each of these cases, there was no criminal report filed. So then it fell upon the people surrounding the accused to determine what kind of consequences they should face. And because this was happening outside the criminal justice system, it depends on the values of those people making the decisions. It depends on whether they see the allegation as serious enough to consider and whether they're okay with the idea that that allegation may be true.
Several of the politicians we've talked about thus far are conservative. As you mentioned, Matt Manweller is a Republican. Joe Fain is a Republican. Brett Kavanaugh is seen as having a conservative judicial record. But Dave Minert ran in progressive circles. Do you see any differences when it comes to where someone lands on the political spectrum in terms of how assault allegations are handled?
I think this is a controversial opinion, but not necessarily. I think that sexual assault and harassment is a nonpartisan issue. And no matter someone's party affiliation, I think groups, people in in-groups tend to close ranks around one another. I mean, we saw that here in Seattle with the allegations against Seattle Mayor Ed Murray. He remained mayor 6 months after the initial child sex abuse allegations came out, and the city council did effectively nothing. And this is one of the most progressive cities, supposedly, in the country.
Recently, I interviewed a woman named Sarah Schott for the podcast I co-host for KUOW, Battle Tactics for Your Sexist Workplace, and she talked about what happened after she accused a man that she worked with of sexual assault years ago. Like Dave Minert, this man ran in progressive politics. He also turned out to be a serial harasser, but he gained a lot of prominence at the national political level. And Sarah said that part of the problem was that lots of people knew about this man's behavior, right? She actually compared it to villagers in an old-timey movie who knew a monster lived in their midst, but they just decided not to drive the monster out because he was kind of beneficial.
There's too many villages where nobody picks up a pitchfork. Essentially, they're like, you know, Dracula is actually really useful. You know, I think he's kind of a jerk. He's kind of a jerk, but I've never actually seen him suck the blood out of anyone. So
I thought that was an interesting comparison. And then actually after the episode, I heard from a listener who said that, you know, she thought that that was a problematic comparison. Here's what she said. When we think of perpetrators as monsters, we lose the ability to understand them and understand why people support and encourage them and why they can so often be successful and have their crimes go unchecked and unpunished. That's a lot to think about, but what do you think about that idea of calling someone a monster, not calling someone a monster, and what that means for how these things happen?
Well, I don't think I would ever fault an accuser's description of a perpetrator of violence as a monster, because that person might consider the perpetrator their personal monster, and that's something that's contained in their personal story, and I'm not here to judge what that person represents to them. However, I do think when we refer to perpetrators of violence or harassment as monsters more generally, it makes them out to be something exotic when actually the behavior is very, very common. I actually use a term called garden variety rape to try and communicate this idea that rape is actually exceptionally common and it's not a stranger jumping out of the bushes with a knife, typically speaking, for 80% of people who say they've been raped. It's someone that they know.
Hmm. Well, what changes have you seen in how the media talks about sexual assault? I guess that acknowledgement that it's not a stranger jumping out of the bushes might be one change.
Yeah, I think there have been very, very fast-paced changes in journalism and how we're talking about sexual assault. Back in the day, newspapers only used to cover sexual assault if it was something that came in a police report or a criminal trial, and the police and prosecutors were the gatekeepers of truth. But we know now that most sexual assaults aren't reported to police and definitely not prosecuted through the criminal justice system. So what do we do outside of those systems? I think that journalists are learning that you can rely on other sources of information to bolster the credibility of these stories. You don't have to just rely on cops and prosecutors as gatekeepers.
We have less than a minute left, but I wanted to know what you want people to understand about your reporting, looking at allegations of sexual assault, particularly against powerful figures.
I think it's important to recognize that credibility doesn't just come from the criminal justice system, and that because most of this falls outside the criminal justice system, it's important to find other ways of finding truth and to keep an open mind.
KUOW reporter Sydney Brownstone, thank you so much for talking with me about this.
Thank you, Jeannie.
Sydney's covered several stories of sexual misconduct by state and local politicians. After the break, you'll hear from your host, Bill Radke. I'm Jeannie Yandel.
It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. How do you explain the exploration of life on Mars to a curious simpleton? Well, that's Dave Cuomo's job. He's the Science Interpretation Program Supervisor at the Pacific Science Center, and he's leading an event this Friday called Science for Curious Simpletons. Dave, welcome.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm great. You know, I consider myself a curious simpleton. And exploring life on Mars sounds very important and complicated. Why dumb it down for somebody like me?
Well, it's not a matter of dumbing it down. It's about inspiring your curiosity, really, to make you curious about Mars. Let me ask you a question.
Mm.
What do you think it takes for life to exist?
I'm going to guess it takes water and some kind of atmosphere that life can sustain itself on.
It definitely takes water, and an atmosphere is certainly useful. It also takes organic chemicals. It takes carbon-based chemistry, and it takes an energy source. And what we've been doing is looking to see if on Mars these three things ever existed at the same place at the same time. Mars has fascinated us for thousands of years, really. It's been visible to the human eye, so you can't really say who first discovered Mars, because it's like who first discovered the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
But we've been fascinated by it for thousands of years, and just 100 years ago, it was thought it was possible there was vegetation on Mars.
Right. So how would you explain the exploration of life on Mars to a sophisticated person, and then how would you explain it to me, a curious simpleton?
Well, I would actually explain it in much the same way. We're looking for whether or not there was ever water on Mars. What we were able to do was find that there are minerals on Mars that can only form in standing liquid water. In order for these minerals to form in that environment, you need water. But there's something funny about Mars. Right now, there's not enough air for water to exist as a liquid. There's not enough air pressure. So if we've found minerals that only form in liquid water, what does that tell us about the atmosphere on Mars in the past?
Yeah, what happened to the air? How do you figure that out?
Exactly. What happened to the air? Well, we started looking at Mars, and we realized that Mars, a compass would not work on Mars. And do you know what causes a compass to work here on Earth?
Magnetic pull.
Yeah, that's right. It lines itself up with the north and the south magnetic poles here on Earth. The Earth has this active magnetic sphere around it. It's like a big giant magnet in space.
Mm-hmm.
Mars is not. But it does have evidence that in the past, it used to have this magnetism. So we started wondering, does the magnetism in any way affect whether or not there's an atmosphere? There's this stream of particles traveling off the sun. We call it the solar wind. We started thinking maybe the solar wind, without this magnetic field protecting the atmosphere, stripped away Mars's atmosphere. So we sent a spacecraft to look at Mars, to actually dive into the atmosphere, to judge the interaction between the upper atmosphere and the solar wind. And we find, yeah, it seems as though the solar wind could have been a factor in eliminating Mars's atmosphere.
Is this the spacecraft that lands next month on Mars?
No, the spacecraft that lands next month goes even to the next question. So the spacecraft that did that is currently in orbit around Mars. It is called MAVEN, and it went to see the interaction between the solar wind and the atmosphere. So now we know that not having a magnetosphere affected Mars. So the question is, what happened to the magnetosphere?
Yeah.
And here on Earth, we know that the magnetosphere is generated by the molten interior of the planet. So does Mars have a molten interior? And that's what InSight's going to find out. And it lands on Mars on November 26th. It's actually at noon Pacific time. It will land on Mars, and it's going to have instruments to be able to detect Mars quakes, to be able to detect how Mars might wobble as it spins, as it rotates, and also to detect temperatures below the surface of Mars to help us understand whether Mars has a molten interior.
And we just have a minute left, Dave. May I ask a question that only a curious simpleton would ask?
Sure.
If Martians are not invading, why should I care?
If Martians are not invading, why should we care? Well, it's a part, first of all, it's a part of human curiosity. Mm-hmm. But also, by finding out whether or not life formed on Mars, it could tell us a lot about the evolution of life here on Earth. One thing we know about life is that it's actually it is all over the planet Earth. So if Mars did evolve life at one point in time, certainly never or probably never was more complicated than a single-celled organism, but it might still be somehow survived, protected from the harsh ultraviolet radiation that bathes the surface of Mars deep underground. And the type of adaptations that organism would have had to have developed to survive such a harsh environment could be very fascinating.
Yeah, adaptability might come in handy here on Earth. Dave Cuomo is a NASA Solar System Ambassador and the Science Interpretation Program Supervisor at Pacific Science Center. You can hear him this Friday evening, 6 o'clock, at the Science Center Planetarium. The event, again, is Science for Curious Simpletons. Dave, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in to The Record. The show is produced by Amina Al-Sadi, Ajua Jimma-Brempong, Allison Bruzek, and Sophie Reed. Our social media producer is Bree Ripley. Good to have you along with us. I'm Bill Radke.